All right, so once again, we're traveling over through Skype to jolly old England, Spoonful of Sugar, Mary Poppins, all that. We got Maddie Harland on the phone. Hey, Maddie.
Hey, Paul.
So we kind of have got a few things to talk about. We talked not too long ago and about the latest issue of Permaculture Magazine, some new books in the hopper. And we touched onto a few things, but we ran out of time. So now we're going to try and pick up where we left off and get this stuff talked about. I think, you know, so the number one question that I have at the top of my list is, when will the English version of Sepp's new book be out?
Okay, at the moment it's being translated. It then needs to go through an editorial process, which will be me and Patrick Whitefield. Then we design it at the speed of lightning, get it all proofed, go to press, and we have it in our hands as an e-book and a printed book by the beginning of October. That's the plan. Probably the e-book will be available by September.
Now, is there a special fast track for giant guys in overalls?
Giant guys in overalls who are going to be reviewing would receive a review copy of the e-book edition. So as soon as that's ready, it is for you.
Because I remember when Sepp's last book came out, you got me a copy 6 weeks before everybody else, and I had to brag about that at least 100 times.
Okay, well, we'll have to excel ourselves now, and I'll get you a copy of the e-book before I've even seen it.
I just like being special.
you don't say.
That was good. So the next thing I got written down is a thing that we started to touch on a little bit, and I wanna jump onto it even more now, because at the PDC I was just at, so I just finished being 4 weeks away, and started off with a 2 week PDC followed by a couple weeks with Sepp Holzer.
Yeah.
And during the PDC, they got to the part of the PDC where it's like, okay, we're going to talk about, you know, alternatives to poop management.
Uh-huh.
And well, you know, that's part of the official PDC program. I'm not sure what they call it, but it's like, you know, and using it, waste is not the appropriate word, because it's not a waste. It's something to be used.
Yeah.
To close some loops.
Yep.
And so one of the things you know, they were talking, and then I said, well, what about a tree bog? And their response was kind of like, well, what the hell is a tree bog? And then like 7 or 8 people that were there at this PDC were like, you know, they knew what a tree bog was. But so apparently I got introduced to some of the folks there. But I have only heard of it ever being done in England. And I know that you have some knowledge about tree bogs. I think there was even an article in Permaculture Magazine about a year ago, a little more than a year ago.
Oh, we've had articles here and there on our website and in the printed edition about tree bogs since the very beginning, because the concept was invented by a guy called Jay Abrahams, who is a microbiologist by training. He builds waste ecological treatment systems, which I can briefly describe a bit later on if you wish. And he invented the tree bog for situations. And he's also a passionate permaculture designer. He picked up a copy of Bill Mollison's Designer's Manual years ago. And, you know, the light came on and he realized that he could take the principles and applied ecology of permaculture, use his skills and knowledge as a microbiologist, and work out incredibly creative and sensible and low-tech ways of cycling poop, as you lovely Americans call it, into nutrients. And but a tree bog has got a different yield. It doesn't yield compost. So we've got tree bogs at the Sustainability Centre, and I've seen tree bogs working effectively on sites that have festivals, so they have, you know, big impact of human beings and their nutrients for limited periods of time, and you need to deal with it. And what it is in a nutshell is it is like a dual vault twin composting toilet, like that. So it's you climb up little steps, you have a platform. That platform is surrounded, in our case we use chicken wire to stop, because we're a public site, we don't want children to be investigating the contents of the tree bog or ghastly as being.
Because kids are a little different than what I expected.
So Johnny A5 saying, this is a really interesting building, and, you know, climbing in through the willow. And we don't want that. We also don't want
pots.
We don't want vermin in it. So the idea is that you surround the platform with chicken wire that keeps out, you know, things like rats that like to eat all sorts of unspeakable things, and keeps out small humans. And you build a structure over it, like a, you know, it can be as aesthetic as you like. We've got a lovely tree bog story on permaculture.co.uk written by Tim Green, which is how to build one. So you put a shed over the top, for privacy and to keep the rain, you know, off the system. And you can have it as a, you know, you can, if it's on a public site, we've got one that's got two holes, so you can, you know, keep one closed to let the pile go down just as you would with a twin vault composting toilet, and have the other one open and functioning. And you sit on a toilet seat in the same way as you would any normal compost loo or loo. But the idea is that surrounding the bottom you plant willow, because willow is, as you know, incredibly hungry biomass generator, and you also can plant things like deep rooting plants like comfrey as well, that will suck up all the nutrients. And the idea is that your customer comes in, leaves the material deposit of pure, you know, lovely poop and urine, and then covers it with a little bit of sawdust or other carbon-based material, and then the willow takes that, sucks up all the you know, the liquid, sucks up, creates symbiosis with the nutrients, uses them, puts on growth, and then annually you can coppice that willow and use it for biomass, so basketry, crafts. I mean, we actually coppice our willow on site at the Sustainability Centre, and then we reuse it for planting and weaving living willow fences. But some of it we sell as a yield. So instead of looking for a yield in terms of soil compost from the poop, we're looking at yield from the biomass instead. Now, why do you do this? Why don't you just build a twin vault toilet and use the poop for compost? Well, on a public site, first of all, who wants to dig out unknown composted feces from a system? Not many people. It's one thing on a domestic scale harvesting poop, but on a you know, public site, it's a different matter. So you know, but most people don't mind going around and coppicing willow and cutting the comfrey, and indeed using that to, you know, activate the system. So that's one reason for it, particularly if you don't, you know, you don't know who's pooping, you don't know what kind of pathogens you've got, you don't particularly want people on a public site to clean out the utility and, you know, handle human waste. So that's one reason for it. Also, it's fast, and it's a great way of growing willows for crafts, living structures, and you could indeed coppice it on a longer cycle and then use it for Kachelhoffens, you know, for small diameter seasoned wood for wood burning, because it burns really hot once it's been seasoned for a good couple of years. So that's the rationale of it.
Now, is it something that you do only in the spring and summer?
What, the coppicing?
No, the tree bog.
No, so in use all year round. What you might want to do if it's really busy is you might want to say we'll build an area with straw bales as a pissoir. So we don't want to encourage people to urinate into the structure because it will become too anaerobic, too wet. We want to keep... we want to keep this as a dry system as much as possible. And it's very important to site it in a place where photosynthesis is able to happen. It's no good having it in some dark and shady corner. You have to obviously think about watercourses, springs, areas that are liable for flooding, as you would any composting system, particularly using human faeces.
So, and that kind of leaves one of my, this is a stupid question. I know we're talking about a very serious topic, but so you said what Americans call poop. What do you call it in England?
Oh, well, it depends who we're talking to. You know, if we're talking to the Queen, we don't mention such things to Mom whatsoever. You know, the Japanese say, where may I rest? If they're inquiring where you know, the powder room might be, euphemistically. Well, we call it poo or shit.
Poo. Okay. All right. There you go. So,
poop means something else that is gaseous from the same orifice.
Poop is farting?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, man, you got for speaking English, it seems like our English is really different from yours.
Well, you know, you've evolved in a different way.
Oh, I should write that down. Maddie Harlan says that our English is evolved.
And the other thing is that, you know, visitors tend to throw far too much sawdust or straw into tree bogs, and you do have to try and keep this ratio between fecal matter and carbon. Just like you do a compost loo, you need to keep it in balance. You don't want it too dry, you don't want it too wet. And then we've got experimenters around the place who are looking at kind of like beetles and tiger worms that they can introduce into this composting system to speed up the whole process as well. So I think that's kind of interesting permacultural idea, that you have a composting system and then you have, you know, all the flora, the fauna of the system, and that you consciously add, you know, that kind of living flora into the system to keep it even more balanced and activated. Some people say that you can have a tree bog in an existing woodland. We've certainly experimented with it under beech and sycamore. I would think alder would work quite well in an existing system. What we find the main problem is, though, is that you really need a certain level of photosynthesis. So if the woodland's too... if it's too dark and there isn't this sort of vigour of photosynthesis, then it takes too long for it to break down to be on a 12-month cycle, and it can get a bit stinky. But I've used tree bogs personally. There's nothing quite like getting up on a platform and being surrounded by this beautiful womb of willow, cover while you contemplate the universe and rest in a Japanese way.
Contemplate the universe. That's what it is.
Absolutely.
And rest. Yeah. excuse me. You just mentioned alder.
Yeah.
I think I would not use alder in a tree bog.
Yeah.
And it's because alder is a nitrogen fixer, and I think I'd much rather have something that is a nitrogen pig.
I think you're totally right. And there is somewhere in my memory a list of what trees work surrounding tree bogs and what don't. So I ought to kind of have a look for that.
So we have a thread out of Permies called Poop Beast. Poop Beast. And so then the idea is that these are the species that would be good to plant around a tree bog or a dry outhouse.
Right.
And for a dry outhouse, then you're going to be typically someplace where, because a willow requires a lot of moisture. And so in order for to use a willow, you know, there's some areas where a willow isn't going to work because it's not wet enough. In which case, typically cottonwoods and poplars seem to be the rule.
I've heard that poplars are good. The other thing I would say is that in the UK you wouldn't want to use goat willow because goat willow doesn't like being coppiced. And that's another important consideration that if you're going to with our tree bogs, we let the trees take care of it. You know, sycamore's a hungry creature. That's great. But because we're coppicing, we want to use very specific willows that are good for crafts, basketry, living fences.
Yeah. So then it has more to do with stacking your functions than with, like, whether or not the willow is going to... Because the willow will, like, take a root and stick a straw straight into it and suck it right out.
Yeah.
But and then most other tree species are going to, like, when they start getting anywhere near poop, they go, I'm not going to come near that. That's too hot. I can't touch it.
Yeah.
And so they'll...
Yeah, but
they'll keep their distance.
Poop is above ground... the ice,
right.
You know, so there is some saturation of the ground around it, but
right.
But it's not like the roots are directly into raw poop.
I would be curious to see if, like, you've got a very active time, and then you hook up a respirator system and pull back your chicken wire.
Yeah.
And go digging into that.
Yeah.
And I would not be surprised if you find roots right up in there.
I bet you would. I bet you would. Just from my experience of normal compost systems, not necessarily tree bog ones, and just knowing how the roots just love and are attracted to all the nutrients from
right.
a composting system next to a native hedgerow.
Well, and I think it's only the roots of certain species are that bold.
Yeah.
And then, of course, what you're doing is you're trying to convert poop into willows.
Yeah.
And then willow, of course, being pretty safe and benign. And then if somebody was on any kind of medication or if they, you know, had any kind of sickness or anything that might have been passed through the poop, the tree just takes that right in real fast. But... And this is where I have my concern about the tree bogs, and I would say that in late fall and in winter, and even really early spring, I think I would hang a sign on the steps up to the tree bog that would say closed for the winter. And my concern would be that somebody would give a gift to the tree.
Yeah.
Euphemistically,
yeah,
and the tree is pretty dormant, and then with the rains of winter, then even though you've got it kind of protected to keep it dry,
yeah, we do because the whole platform has a roof over it.
True, and I suppose that if you were to build it on a bit of a hill,
yeah,
and you know surrounded by willows, then it might be fine.
You certainly don't want to build it in a boggy little dip. You know, you don't want to...
Oh, absolutely.
A poop pond. So, yeah,
yeah,
and there has to be some design. Now, I mean, this is a very good question because the tree bog idea was to be able to create a fairly quick platform, and initially it was designed really for sort of like summer festivals where people would come, they'd fill it all up, having a great time at a festival, and then they'd go away again, and the tree bog would have the other three seasons to recover.
Right.
At the Sustainability Centre, it is a year-long installation, but it's there primarily to serve our little eco campsite. So,
yeah. So
you know, there isn't the load in the dormant winter. And also, we're in the south of England. We don't have sort of monsoons in winter, and we have a fairly long growing season where that willow is in leaf. You know, it's not much of the year that willow is entirely dormant. So, you know, I take your point. The other thing is, if you coppice the willow, then it's going to want to regenerate much, much faster than if you had sort of like standard poplars around that weren't being cut back.
So this is where I think that the two are very similar, the dry outhouse and the tree bog.
Yeah.
Where big function of the dry outhouse is that much like with the tree bog, you've got urine diversion.
Mm.
But the dry outhouse is built in such a way that you build it on top of a little mound. So that way, any water that lands on the roof of the dry outhouse is diverted away from the pit.
Totally.
And then at the same time, you surround it with cottonwoods and poplars, which will eventually get a root in there and, basically stick a straw right into that bowl.
Yeah.
And be pulling out the material, and there's not a lot of water thrown in there. I imagine that if it started to ever fill up, because in theory, with a dry out house, which is what happens, on my understanding is with a tree bog, is that you you'll have your summer event, and then you'll come back next summer, and there's nothing there. It's all gone.
Absolutely. It's totally and utterly gone.
Yeah. And then the great perk here is like exactly what you're saying earlier, is no one has to get in there with a shovel and start rooting it out and fooling with it, which is an awesome perk.
Exactly. And also, let's face it, when you're in, you know, when you've got your own personal composting toilet and it's in a family situation, you know whether anyone's taking a contraceptive pill, you know what kind of medication that people are using, so you know you've got some controls there. When you've got a utility like this on a public site, you have no idea what kind of pathogens, what kind of medication is being introduced into that system, so you don't really want to go in there and handle it, and you might not. You know, you'd have to be very careful about what you put it on as well.
Right, right.
So that's another reason for that design, is to be very low maintenance. But like any other poop system, it's got to be well designed. It's got to be well managed. So no, don't plant it in a depression in the ground. You know, have a good roof so that it's not getting rained on, you know, plant the right willows around it, or if you're planting using other trees, research the trees, make things poop hungry, not just fast growing.
Right.
And think carefully about the amount of photosynthesis, so don't site it in a dark part of the woodland. So, you know, all common sense really, isn't it?
You would think it would be, but I think that a big part of why we're recording this kind of thing is because we're trying to convey this knowledge, which turns out to be very uncommon. I mean, I think there's a reason why outhouses are banned in so many areas, and it has to do with the fact that there were people who they were missing tidbits of knowledge, and so they did. They built it in a floodplain, or they built it in a place that is a place that collects water, they did it wrong, and it was a problem. It was basically you're pooping in your neighbor's drinking water.
Well, it's
and that's dangerous. Not okay.
It's very dangerous. And it's like we have a woodland burial site at the Sustainability Centre. And before you can establish something like that, where we bury human beings, dead, not alive, obviously.
Let's call that plan A.
They can't be embalmed. We don't bury composite wood, you know, veneered coffins. We don't bury hardware like brass fittings. You know, we don't bury junk with the whole thing has to be organic. It has to be buried to a certain depth, which is statutory in the UK. And before you can even open a site like that, you have to have planning permission from local government department. You have to have a whole environmental survey, and you have to have a hydrological survey, because you can't start putting corpses decomposing over watercourses. I mean, that's theoretically what happened to the Austin family. Oh no, it was the Brontes in Yorkshire. They lived next to this graveyard, and I think their water source was right next to it, and they all died of all sorts of ghastly diseases in early life, you know, relatively young. So, you know, just utter common sense. And some of these regulations from, in our case in the UK, the Environment Agency, are completely there to protect us from our ignorance rather than just to be red tape and stop innovation.
So let's talk a moment. So what do you call this? You've got a thing on your property?
Yeah, this is at the sustainabilitycentre.org, if you want to check us out. And what it's part of our charitable work. So it's a business that seeds, it's a not-for-profit that seeds all its returns into the main educational charity of the Sustainability Centre. And it's called the South Downs Natural Burial Site. And it is a wooden burial, which we had a intensively overstood, damaged, mainly conifer plantation, and over time in small sections we've taken out the conifers, and we've buried people using trigonometry to plot the site, you know, down to the nth degree, and then anyone can be buried there, and it's completely open. So we have the most basic DIY services where the family carry the coffin. We use cardboard coffins, willow coffins, which we like willow a lot, sometimes bamboo, as long as it's organic.
It'll compost.
It's got a compost. And then we use shrouds. Sometimes people say we want a shroud. And we use a horse and a cart to take it down. Every grave is hand dug; it's not mechanized. And then, as we plant these humans, we see natural regeneration of this woodland area. We get beautiful wildflowers. We get ash suckering, and we, in some instances, we've left some of the mature broadleaf trees in, like we had a whole load of yew tree, which is the climax species of our chalk downland ecology. So we left those in because they're quite sort of special to us, and we left in some of the beeches. And then we've replanted, the Royal We, because this is Al Blake and his team of guys that run the woodland burial. And so sometimes it's a really simple ceremony. We've buried people who are very religious, but we have completely ecumenical view. So we've buried people from the Church of England. We've had Celtic burials. We've had secret mystery Egyptian burials that we weren't allowed to watch. You know, everything from atheist, humanist to conventional Christian to Buddhist. We've even had Hell's Angel biker ceremonies where the hog the Harley has got a sidecar, and that carries the coffin, and it goes down into the woodland, and the dudes come along, and they do their burial, and then they have the party afterwards. So it's very, 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 it's an incredibly culturally diverse project. But what it does is that people then feel a commitment and an investment to the overall 55 acres of this educational project called the Sustainability Centre. And they come back and they visit their loved one's place of interment, and they volunteer. And they come and they get involved with the project, which is fantastic. And just the other last detail is there's no memorial headstone, no crosses, nothing. It's plotted and put in a fireproof safe, the exact location of each burial. But then the site returns to natural woodland. And all, if it's enhanced in any way, if we plant anything, it has to be native. You know, we can't go down there and start planting, you know, crazy, inappropriate plants, because the idea is to restore the ecology, the natural ecology of the area, and so it then becomes a beautiful nature reserve where people can go and just be for generations afterwards. It's incredibly popular.
Okay, well, I want to ask you about the particulars on the how to and why that particular how to and things like that. And so my first thought is like, okay, they're going in a box.
Yeah.
It's going to be like, for example, a willow, a box made out of willow wood.
No. It's the willow coffins are, it's wood would make you think they're woven.
So a woven box.
Yeah, it's a woven basket.
So more of a basket. So they're in a basket. They're in a shroud in a basket. Is that right?
Possibly.
So then as the hole gets filled in, the basket probably gets smunched. So now there's going to be contact between the soil and the willow stuff.
Yeah.
So then the idea is that composting is going to happen here.
It sure does. I mean, when you put the soil in and it's a cardboard box, because some people elect to have cardboard boxes, there's sometimes a point where the soil is, you know, quite heavy, and then suddenly there's as you fill it in, you backfill the grave, it goes
as the kind of goes thump.
Yeah, as the
yeah. Okay. All right. Now, I would think that for aerobic composting, decomposition, you would want to not get too terribly deep. And so typically we hear 6 feet under, 6 feet deep.
Yeah.
But now how is that the depth that you go to?
There's a statutory requirement. So if it's a double grave, so you've got one on top of the other potentially, then it has to be deeper than 6 foot. But I think statutory it has to be 6 foot. But the other detail that perhaps I need to pass on is that the soil or the subsoil, because we're on chalk downland, we've got fairly thin soil. It quickly goes to a kind of flinty, chalky subsoil, and then it goes down to pure chalk. So this is quite a curious way. We've dug up ancient Celtic artifacts on and near the site because it's on an ancient trackway with tumuli, Neolithic burial or mounds around or nearby the site. It is quite a dry process. It's not like sticking a body in a bit of a damp hole. And it becoming very anaerobic very quickly. Do you see what I mean? There is a process. I haven't researched this by digging anyone up, Paul, but because it's so chalky, it's not a yeah, 6 feet under. It is obviously anaerobic, but it's fairly benign.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I guess I was kind of thinking, you know, I guess I was kind of hoping that it would be a process where it was closer to the surface, so that way there can be more decomposition.
But then the foxes,
it sounds like
the foxes would dig up the bodies and eat them.
Yeah, that's true.
You know,
that's
what has to be rammed at 6 feet down.
Obviously, yeah.
You know, on what is very, you know, the backfilling has to be pretty good. Otherwise, wild animals would come and have supper. And it would be gory for the relatives.
And when you say chalk, it makes me think of something that's heavy in lime.
Well, it is.
Which makes me think it's a high alkalinity.
Oh, very. Yeah.
And then lime would be something that would be used as a preservative.
Well, this is the curious thing, and this is why some of the Celtic artifacts have been quite well preserved in the chalk over a couple of millennia or so, because of the ecology of the area. So, you know, yeah, that, you know, this is much more about, can I give you the rationale? The reason for doing this is, if you think about it conventionally, when you get a great big hearse and you drive it over a distance, and then you get your relative all wrapped in silk and dressed up to the nines in this often a mahogany coffin, which
right
is, you know, a waste of fundamentally what is a precious resource, with great big brass handles. I looked at Michael Jackson's coffin and I thought, boy, that's the antithesis to an ecological burial, having, you know, all that brass and hardwood and, you know, sumptuous symbols of wealth, really.
Right. And probably big gobs of glue and all kinds of synthetic materials.
It's synthetic. You then embalm the body so that it doesn't offend anyone if there's any viewings, and that again is a very chemical process. And then at the end result, you don't necessarily bury it, you stick it in an industrial furnace and then release all those toxins and PCBs specifically into the local atmosphere that blows all over us guys, and we wonder why we're all getting cancer.
Right, right.
So we've industrialized death in our society. And so the idea of the woodland burial is to allow people psychologically to take control, that they have complete choice about how they bury their friend or their relative, and they have complete choice in how they're handling it. They can make it personal, religious, in any way they like. It's as long as it's not, you know, inappropriate or offensive or against the law, they can do it how they like. So it's a very empowering social dynamic. It is also supporting an educational project, so the profits are going into the educational program at the Sustainability Centre and helping continue, you know, all the courses and all the stuff that we do. From, you know, we literally do stuff for very tiny kids all the way through, you know, we really are cradle to grave. And then at the same time, you're restoring what was a monoculture, spruce monoculture, into a biodiverse, beautiful native woodland as well. So it's a permaculture design. It's a multifunctional permaculture design that works on a psychological, a social, and an ecological level.
So 50 times less bad than conventional, and still room for improvement, but you've got to get your legal authorities to be possibly less freaked out about some of the things you might do for improvement.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you've got to make sure that you're not doing anything in an ecologically sensitive area that would harm the ecology of the site or people. And
right. And
also, there are stringent laws about how you bury people. You know, you have to you know, this has to be done within the country's legal structures wherever you're from.
Right, right. And as you pointed out, that all that legal stuff comes from people having gotten seriously ill in the past and dying from it.
Oh, yeah, like so quantum. And just one other thing, though, and you know, there's also an economic yield. And this whole education program and the whole establishment of it at the Sustainability Center has only been possible because this not-for-profit business is so successful and it's known all over the bioregion. So, you know, from a commerce point of view, in the right circumstances, run with sensitivity and professionalism, this is quite a good way of making money.
And true.
It's important in permaculture that we have economic sustainability, not in the conventional resource stripping, unethical sense that most of the world is practicing at the moment, but we have to have, just like we need ecological cycles, we also need economic cycles. Otherwise, our projects, particularly our public and larger scale projects, will not succeed.
See, I'm listening to this, and I'm just thinking this is really fascinating. And we have not yet done a podcast on this topic, and my mind is just buzzing with ideas of what I want to, I don't know, talk about. If these ideas are not good ideas, I wish to understand why they're not good ideas. And so the first thing that pops into my head is like, I see the need to put the body 6 feet under. I like the idea that the soil is not chalky, because I kind of want to see. I'm concerned that the chalkiness is going to impede decomposition, and instead it's more of a preservative than a composting kind of thing.
Okay.
Is what's in my head.
Ask you a question though. Why
okay.
are you in a hurry to decompose the body?
Well, that's a lovely question. I would have to say that
we're not cycling nutrients in this system. We're cycling economic and social and ecological yields. We're not cycling nutrients. So why?
I guess maybe it's like each person might have their different ideas on how they wish to have their body dealt with.
Yeah.
And while some people might be like, I'm all for the chalk package, which is going to be a little bit more preservative, I kind of like to think that I want to go back to being soil. To me, the idea of, because here's, let me just finish this thought real quick, and that is that suppose for a moment that I'm dead and my body is 6 feet under, but that it's 6 feet under in such a way that I will break down quickly, and I like the idea that like somebody puts an acorn, you know, 6 feet above my navel. and then the idea is, and then maybe even where the acorn is planted from you know, my mid body up, you can like even mix in a little bit of compost all the way to the surface. So that way that acorn is stuck in the soil, and I want it to be an acorn, not a transplanted oak tree, definitely an acorn. And then the taproot that forms from that will go right through me and eat me, and then I will, in a way, become this oak tree. And then my remains are not like taking up space. I've gone back to being soil. And
yeah. Okay.
I just like the idea of that. So it's different. It's different than what you're saying. But
yeah.
But I mean, like, I had never thought of it before until you started talking about this.
Well.
Oh, and I have to make a quick comment that you used the word plant humans, like you're going to grow a human tree. Look, little people, little babies sprouting off the tree.
Well, I mean, all I'll say is that, you know, you're using these, you know, woven or cardboard or organic biodegradable shrouds. So for a start, the contact with the soil is it's very different to having a mahogany coffin buried 6 feet under. So,
oh, yeah.
You know, you're going to get a reasonable period of decomposition. And as you said that, Paul, I just had this thought about Princess Diana, who was buried in a in a lead-lined coffin, which is the tradition, which is why it was so heavy as those guys were pallbearing it. And, of course, the tradition of that is that you don't decompose, you desiccate. So, you know, they dig up these, you know, that means that under Westminster Abbey and other places where they bury the great and the good, as they're called, you know, you've got loads of desiccated remains and bones. I think, you know, the contact with some level of oxygen and soil and this fairly organic environment, you know, in terms of what the body's in, means that it's going to be reasonably fast. But we can't choose our subsoil or our, you know, what's below the soil. We're on chalk, so that's what we got.
Right. Oh, right, right, right. And I can see how it's like there could be several plots that are going to be natural burials, and some are going to be chalk, and some are going to be, you know, possibly peat, and
peat
some are going to be...
Peat would preserve you even more. I doubt it would
yeah.
be peat, because peat
yeah.
is always from a damp environment, so I doubt you could even get permission to bury in peat. But, of course, we get... sometimes peat bogs are excavated in the British Isles, and we get very well preserved, very, very early examples of humans coming out of the peat, so much so that we can analyse their stomach content and get a view of what they used to eat. It's very exciting when that happens.
Wow. And then there's going to be some places where they're going to be a little bit more biologically active. And because I suggest peat because with chalk, you're going to have extremely high pH and thus preservation. Mm. And then with peat, a very low pH
but
and thus preservation.
No, because peat also, peat environments preserve.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's because, and right. They're both preserving.
Mm.
And then you're going to have, and then I'm suggesting that there's something in the middle.
Sure.
Where it doesn't preserve, and instead you return to being soil. And I, as we're talking about this, I'm just kind of thinking, oh, this is so cool. And then I'm imagining, and then of course, you know, I just, my mind's going wild with the idea of returning to soil, and it just kind of seems like I can't, at this point in time, I would think that would be completely illegal everywhere, not because it's a bad idea, but because people just haven't gotten there yet.
Yeah.
I suspect it's an excellent idea, and it just has, you know, I am not aware of it being implemented. Maybe it is implemented somewhere.
Well, it's implemented all over Britain now. It's a really popular service that is... you know, becoming increasingly common. And we even have something called the Natural Death Centre.
Wow.
That coordinates all the sites in the UK.
Yeah, I like the idea of the natural death thing, and but being a tree.
Well, I like the idea of being a tree. Now, if I can be slightly off the wall here, of course, in the Himalayas, you have sky burials where you get dismembered and then they leave you on some craggy outcrop, and the vultures and the, you know, the birds of prey come and eat you. And I quite fancied that, actually, as well. I quite fancied being eaten by raptors.
Okay.
But I don't.
I think that if they drop a chunk of you on, you know, near some kids, that could be kind of awkward.
So I don't think that's going to be an option for me, you know, in my lifetime or my at the end of my life, unless I find myself in, you know, the edge of Tibet or somewhere.
Right. Well, and then there's the thing with the funeral pyre.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, it seems, if I recall correctly, popular in Star Wars.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've actually been to Ghats in Nepal, where you publicly, you know, burn your, you publicly cremate your relative. And,
right.
And then, you know, at the end of it, where there's a few little bits of bones left, you actually toss the rest into the river that runs by the Ghats. And that is an amazing experience because, as I said, we've kind of industrialized, medicalized, and made a taboo death in the West. We don't see, you know, unless you come from, say, an Irish wake tradition, you don't generally see publicly the body. You certainly don't have any part of the actual disposal. You know, it usually slides off to music behind purple curtains, and you know, you're nothing to do with the fire. So it's a fascinating experience because it breaks so many taboos, and it sure smells like a bad barbecue.
True. And then, but I also kind of wonder a little bit about, like, I mean, burning a bunch of wood, I think, is not necessarily a really great idea, because I kind of would like to see that wood serve other functions and whatnot.
Well, that's why they evolved this system of sky burial in the Himalayas, because there isn't a
yes.
certain level any tree cover whatsoever. So, and you can't dig into frozen subsoil. So what do you practically do? You recycle the nutrients within the vulture community.
Right, right. And then, of course, when we talk about current cremation, then do they not just cremate just the body?
No.
No, they always cremate the whole damn box, too.
I think they do. And often they talk about sort of fishing out the artificial hips and stuff like that, and then we have this sentimental delusion that, you know, the loved one's ashes really are their ashes, but
it's mostly that box.
Well, it's mostly the box and possibly some of the residue of the previous customer. I mean,
and then there's like some fried formaldehyde going up in the atmosphere too.
Fried formaldehyde, all sorts of stuff. Yeah.
Right, right.
So this is why we started the woodland burial, because we knew that, one, it's a very eco way of going about stuff. It provides a good service. It allows people to design their own event, and we feel that that's very important. And it also restores habitat.
Okay. No, it does. It sounds really excellent and amazing, and I like the idea of being planted on permaculture land. You know, like this is got the word. This is flying the permaculture flag, and this is where you're buried. And I think that's an excellent thing. I think that's a great topic, and I wish to now consider it. Like we've covered that one. Are you ready to go on to the next one?
Sure, Paul.
Okay. I've got one small thing to talk about, and then I want to go into a bigger topic. When I arrived at the PDC 4 weeks ago, it was right after I was talking to you about Sepp's upcoming book in the last podcast. And then and then I knew that some people were on their way to go and see Sepp in Portugal.
Mm-hmm.
And then I arrived at this event, and somebody came to me and said this thing, which sounded false. It sounded like a negative Nelly thing that's getting spread around, and it sounded false right from the very beginning, but this person was adamant that it was true, and I kind of feel like this is how I spend a huge portion of my life, is unraveling these things. And I believe I have thoroughly and completely and utterly unraveled it, but I want to share it with you because I know that you have also been to Portugal. So this will be like I'm going to debunk this myth for the sixth time, and hopefully between you and I, we will put this to rest forever.
Okay.
And this is that when I arrived at the PDC, I had heard that the Portugal project, where Sepp was in Portugal, that the annual rainfall there, it's a desert. and that the annual rainfall there is approximately 6 inches per year.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got somebody who said it's 38 inches per year. So all the stuff that Sepp's been saying is a bunch of bullshit. And it's already wet there. I mean, 38 inches per year, that's more than the rainfall of Seattle.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's nothing special. There's nothing great going on there. So I recall looking at pictures that you sent me and seeing pictures of the site, and it definitely looks like the kind of place that gets 6 inches of rain per year. And then I've checked around with several people, and they felt that. I asked Sepp this question very directly. Sepp then, you know, he puts his hands apart to show how much rainfall they get per year.
Mm.
And so it looked like 6 inches is the average. But he said last year they got only 3.
Yeah, and next year they might
half
get 12. Because climate change is meaning that we have increased precipitation in winter and reduced and droughts in other seasons. So, I mean, climate change is about change and chaos to usual activities. But to me, desert it's not the Sahara there. It's a hot Mediterranean-type country. You know, if you imagine, I can't really give an equivalent in the U.S. because I'm...
Well, I live in mountain desert, where I am now in Missoula,
yeah.
and we get 13 inches of rain per year. And I do think that we're on the edge of what's called desert.
Yeah.
But if you look at some of the hillsides will have nothing going on them. And then we'll see conifer forests in some areas. But I think we're technically mountain desert, but I think, you know, we're on the edge. So I know I just heard you typing. I imagine that you're probably going to go look it up to prove it because that's how you are.
Mm-hmm.
Now I've now checked with many different sources, and I've heard that I've heard anywhere from 6 to 7 inches or so, but that, you know, and that this is indeed Portugal, this spot in Portugal. There might be parts of Portugal that are much damper, but this particular spot in Portugal is a desert.
Yeah.
So,
and the other thing I would say about this is, yes, I mean, desert is defined by rainfall, but desert is also defined by a loss of topsoil and an inability for the tree cover to survive. You know, and the fact is that 90% of the cork oak forest in most parts of the Iberian Peninsula of Portugal, and I'm talking specifically about in the Iberian Peninsula, I'm not talking about any other areas of Portugal, is, you know, 90% of that climax species is dying back. They have such a huge loss of topsoil through agricultural practices that, you know, they plough underneath the cork oaks, and they leave the terraces completely bare. The rain comes all up in one season usually, and it washes that topsoil down the valley, down into the ocean, and you can see from space the bloom that comes out at that estuary mouth that is soil at certain times of the year. And then you have things like rock rose, cistrus, that is then the only thing that can colonize, which is inedible to sheep and inedible to humans, and just becomes a sort of monocultural scab that indicates a brittle and damaged ecology. Now, I'm not an expert in this, but so my understanding of desertification is it's not just about rainfall. It's about rapidly decreasing fertility, rapidly decreasing biodiversity as well, and the destruction of the ecology of an environment.
Right.
Through various factors, and desertification is caused by a loss of annual rainfall. It's caused, as we all know, by felling tree cover, and it's caused by overgrazing.
Okay. Or I find myself getting my hackles up when I hear the word overgrazing. I'm trying to replace that with poor grazing practices.
Well, yes. I mean, you know, it's about looking at capacity, and no one goes around destroying ecologies on purpose. It's done through, you know, usually people overgraze land because they don't have enough land and they're very, very poor, and they're trying to eke out a living in the most difficult, brittle environment. And that's the case with this particular area of Portugal. It's one of the poorest places in Europe. It has one of the highest migrations out of the area from young people. It's a place that is like a dust bowl culture of the 30s. It's got that kind of Steinbeck desperation about it in areas. I mean, and then you go to the coast, and it's a very different financial model. But this is deep in rural Portugal, in a brittle landscape that is desertifying, not just because you've got less rain, but because you've got inappropriate agricultural practices.
Right. I agree. So did you look up the rainfall for the spot?
Without going tippy-tippy-tippy and not concentrating on what we're talking about, I can't, you know, the figures I've got here are not, you know, I can't quite.
Okay.
I can't quite do it.
All right.
But, you know, my point about what is desertification, is it simply about rainfall? No, it's not. That is a very oversimplified understanding of what happens when a brittle ecology goes into a desertification process. And I would so strongly suggest that those critics go and read up Alan Savory, look at holistic management, have a look at, you know, put holistic management, Alan Savory, into our search engine, our little box on permaculture.co.uk. There's a couple of videos there. Follow the links through and really look into this this guy's work, because he's part of this emerging jigsaw of regenerative agricultural techniques, which are involve permaculture, they involve holistic management, key line ploughing, and other practices that, you know, the people like Darren Doherty are taking them all as a suite of techniques and ideas, and are regenerating whole landscapes. And that's what we have to do, is, you know, before we just throw out stuff and poo-poo it and get clever about how many inches have fallen on one part of the country in the world, let's give ourselves an opportunity to do some serious research, because we have a tendency to be iconoclastic, and Sepp is an icon. And you know, it's great fun to shoot him down, but he is an extraordinary man, and you know, it has been an extraordinary experience meeting him, as I'm sure it has for you for the last month. I mean, I know you've met him before.
Yeah, this is my second time visiting with him, and it was excellent. And I mean, so a couple of quick things. Yes, over at permies.com we have a thread called what is it called? Alan Savory Wins an Award.
Yeah.
And we have a variety of videos in this thread, which are Alan Savory and covering some of the techniques of paddock shift systems. And this is where we talk about, you know, rather than saying overgrazing, say poor grazing practices can desertify a land. Good grazing practices can actually reverse desertification, and such an important component and an important difference. And it's kind of like the same thing can be said where if you process your poop improperly, you can poop in somebody's drinking water.
Quite.
But if you do it properly, you don't at all, and you can turn it into, say, a willow tree. You know, so it's all about, you know, you can do it right and you can do it wrong, and it still falls under the same umbrella of doing that. As for Sepp, and that's popular to pick on him, I have some very important news. We had a thread out at permias.com called, and it's still there, called Doubts About Holzer. And apparently somebody claimed to be a client of Holzer. I'm not sure if they really were or not, but I think they may have been. And ended up suing Holzer. And saying, you know, he sucks, he's awful, he's terrible, etc. And I'm visiting with one of the people that came with Sepp from Austria, and they said, oh no, that's been resolved. It's public record. That woman is currently serving jail time for having said all those things.
Mm.
And so you know, it's true. There are a lot of people that you know, you see a great icon doing great things, and then there are people that just want to, I don't know, take it on. When I first heard about it, I wrote out at permias.com, and they're like, okay, Paul, what are you thinking about what this woman is claiming? Because apparently her website is still up saying all these horrible things about Sepp. And I said, it sounds to me like Monsanto gave that woman a big mountain of money if she would do this.
Well, I mean,
it just seems like a Monsanto tactic to me.
Let's get it in perspective. We've got incredible activities on this planet, wholesale destruction of ecosystems, and people are bitching about whether Sepp's the real deal or not. I mean, come on, let's get things in perspective.
Right. I mean, Sepp is going to places, and he is converting them from a wasteland to an oasis. And you've witnessed it firsthand. You've been to the project in Portugal.
I have.
So I just got through watching all kinds of slideshows and whatnot of the projects that he's been doing all over the world in reversing desertification. Mm. And basically, well, you know, basically saving the world, and picture after picture of, like, here is this horrible desolate landscape, and look, we brought lakes back to it.
Mm.
Here is this other horrible desolate landscape; it's a whole different kind, and look, we brought, you know, greenery back to it.
Mm.
And so it's like over and over and over again. Sepp is like really, you know, curing things, really, really healing the world.
And so. He is one man, he's an extraordinary man, but there are other people who are equally extraordinary, equally innovative in different ways. Like, there's a guy working in the Sahel in a whole region of Africa who's restored vast parts of this desert region with his not with lake systems, obviously, because there really isn't any rainwater there.
It's that Zai thing, isn't it? Zai?
In part, yes, that's one technique.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's one. You've got Smit working in
Borneo,
restoring rainforests. You know, there are so many people. You've got Alan Savory,
right,
and all of that regenerative grazing work. You've got guys doing regen ag all over the world. I mean, there are so many great people doing fantastic work. And thank God. Otherwise, you know, I'd be pretty scared if no one was out there doing that stuff.
Right, absolutely.
And this is the microcosm. This is only the very, very beginning of this earth restoration process. You know, we have hardly begun, and no one has it perfect. No one has all the answers. You know, this is the beginning, I hope, of the next millennia of research. So we're still at a profoundly experimental phase.
So I think I conveyed the things I wanted to do. I wanted to make the record clear that the average rainfall where Sepp did his Portugal project is, on average, approximately 6 inches per year.
Yeah, but I think it will vary, because I think you've got...
Of course.
You've got climate chaos, and you might have much bigger precipitation in midwinter. And as the tree cover intensifies in the area, which it is, and as the ecological diversity intensifies, there will be more rain.
Right. So,
I love trees.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And so, I guess my point being is that I think we've nailed that one down. I just felt it was important to clearly express, you know, the rainfall there, because apparently there is a rumor going around of something different, and I've now. Done my research bits to verify it, and you're an observer that was there, and one last little bit of frosting. I do think it's fair to say, like, if somebody's, like, I know that on Sepp's land he gets 30 inches of rain per year in Austria, but it's like most of that comes in the wintertime, and he gets hardly any during the summer. Like, it's almost zero during the summer.
Yeah. And
it's like, you know what? I would much rather have my rainfall cut in half if I could get, I could get it evenly over all the months of the year.
Yeah.
If I could get it evenly over all the months of the year and it's cut in half, that's better than what Sepp's got, because now – Sepp is getting his soil rinsed away, all the nutrients in his soil rinsed away every winter.
Well,
and
this is what happens in Portugal, though, that it all falls at what, from what I understand, it falls in the winter, and then you have incredibly hot, dry summers. So to actually be able to grow vegetables through seasons, you've got to use all those permaculture ideas, all the mulching, and that's what the lakes do. There's this body of water, so early in the morning you get evaporation, which then, you know, you get early morning mists, and and that's why Sepp plants all the edibles around the lakes, because that's where they can most benefit from this,
right,
the water moisture, the moisture in the atmosphere. You know, it's not just about lakes, it's about a very clever integrated design to begin to create diverse food systems for a community.
So I've got one more item on the list, but I'm going to have to ask that we postpone it until our next conversation, Maddie, because I have to pee.
And anyway, we've talked enough.
We have. We've gone on a long, long time. You're probably gearing up the next issue of Permaculture Magazine.
I am.
Maybe the next time we talk, we can talk about what stories are going to be in it. And then we get to hear more about your projects and things of that nature.
And we can ask you questions too, Mr. Wheaton.
Well, okay, fair enough. And so, until next time, if you like this sort of thing, come on out to the forums at permies.com, where we talk about the magnificent Maddie Harland, homesteading, and permaculture all the time.